Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial, but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological, and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcast offers. I dare you.
The Guardian.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir. This week on the podcast, the new breed of police commissioners. They will build as the next step in the turbocharging of local democracy. So why are experts predicting the lowest ever turnout in a national election? Also this week, a gentle remix or a night of the long knives? As David Cameron mulls over his autumn reshuffle, who'll be sitting by the phone and who'll be hoping the Prime Minister doesn't call? Joining me for all of this, The Guardian's Home Affairs editor Alan Travis, the editor of the website Conservative Home, Tim Montgomery, and on the line, the man who knows all of the ins and outs of the police commissioner debate, the editor of the Top of the Cops blog, Sam Chapman. A warm welcome to all of you. Now, on November the 15th, citizens of England and Wales will go to the polls to elect their local police commissioner, or some say about 15% of us will. David Cameron's very excited about it, others have become quite exercised about it. But it's fair to say that so far the idea hasn't quite caught the public's imagination. To find out more about it, I spoke to John Collins of the Police Foundation, an independent think tank. I asked him why the government is pursuing this.
There was a sense that police authorities were too remote from the public, people didn't know about them, didn't know what they did, and as a result that the police service wasn't sufficiently responsive to the views of the public.
Having a single individual, is that likely to improve that situation?
Well, I think that these individuals will certainly be more high profile than the police authorities that they will replace. But there are real challenges for an individual in representing the public across what are often very large police areas. Somewhere like Thames Valley, which spans, I think, about 18 police authorities, or the West Midlands, which runs across a huge number of MPs' constituencies, there'll be big areas and they'll struggle to represent all of the public across those areas.
Break it down for me, because I suppose just the very title, Commissioner, is a bit confusing, because you think that the Commissioner at the moment is a person, certainly in the Met, the person who actually runs the force. But they won't be running the force, will they, in terms of day-to-day operation?
They won't. Chief constables will retain operational independence, so independence over operational day-to-day policing. What the Police and Crime Commissioner will do, well, they'll provide oversight for that, they'll set police force strategy, they'll set the budget, but they won't make day-to-day policing decisions.
How are police officers reacting to this? Do they think it's a good framework?
I think it's well known that there was some scepticism among senior police officers when the idea was first suggested, and some opposition among senior police officers to the reforms. But I think now that they're coming in, now we're less than 3 months from the elections, the police are getting on with making sure that this is as successful as it can be.
So are they making the best of it, or have they been persuaded that this is a good idea?
I'm sure that some of them have been persuaded. I'm sure that some of them are making the best of it. But I think overall the sense is that this is now a reform that has to be made to work.
And there do seem to be a number of people with, shall we say, colourful backgrounds entering the race as well. Aren't people finding that a bit puzzling?
If you look at the candidates who have come forward so far, there are just under 140 confirmed candidates that we know about so far for the 41 areas. About 89 of them are standing on behalf of a political party, and there's just under 50 independents standing at the moment. So at the moment, there's quite a good mixture of party political candidates and independent candidates. Though it has to be said, the independents are fairly unevenly distributed across the forces. In 18 areas, there are no independent candidates at all, but there are 6 independents in Kent, for example, and 5 in Sussex. So what we don't have at the moment is an independent standing in every area, but there may still be more who come forward between now and November. In terms of sort of colourful characters coming forward to stand for an election, I think that's the case in any election. You can see that in general elections or even local elections. But I think we have to trust that local voters will choose the right people to do these jobs.
John Collins from the Police Foundation. Okay, let's go around the table. In the Telegraph, Professor Lawrence Sherman from Cambridge University says that we'll remember 2012 not for the Olympics, but for the election of police commissioners and the parallel creation of a new College of Policing. Tim, do you see things that way?
Well, I'm enthusiastic about these reforms, but probably not quite that enthusiastic. I think the huge value of these commissioners is that there are many communities across Britain at the moment who, particularly marginalised communities, who feel unpoliced. They don't think the police give them enough attention. There are many other people who think that the police have the wrong priorities, perhaps focusing too much on traffic violations and not enough on order. There are big examples, like in the London riots last year, when people didn't think the police were acting in the kind of way, facing down the rioters quickly enough. And what we will have after November are recognisable people that everybody can go to and say, I'm not getting the kind of police force that I want. Those police commissioners won't be able to force the police to change, direct them to arrest or focus on particular people, but they will be able to deliver a more community-orientated police priority. And so perhaps not as big as London 2012, but certainly an incredibly useful reform.
So a more direct impact and greater accountability. Do you see it that way, Alan?
Well, it certainly is needed greater accountability of the police. One of the policy imperatives for the introduction of PCCs is the fact that Theresa May, early in coming to office, succeeded to the police demands for all their Whitehall targets on their spending and performance to be scrapped. We no longer have any targets on policing driving up performance. And this is a mechanism, a democratic accountability mechanism, which Labour recognised just as much as the Conservatives. Labour wanted to introduce directly elected police authority chair people, chairman. We have PCCs from the Conservatives. The two policies are not very far apart. And both are trying to achieve the same thing, which was to drive up performance of the police in more in the public interest. In that sense, it's to be welcomed. The problem with these elections is the timing. They should have taken place in May, what time the London mayoral elections, the other local elections, with a decent turnout. People would have had a mandate. But a combination of the Liberal Democrats and former senior police officers, Lord Condom, Geoffrey Deere from the West Midlands and so on in the Lords, delayed the elections until this dark Thursday night in November, almost as standalone contests, leaving these problems of facing low turnout and possible poor quality candidates.
Tim, was that a bad idea?
No, I completely agree with what Alan just said about the problem of timing. It wasn't something the Conservative half of the coalition wanted. We wanted it at the same time as other elections were happening so that we would maximise turnout. I think there's a lot that's going to be done before November, not least by the Home Office to try and increase awareness. But Alan's absolutely right. I'm afraid partly because of Liberal Democrat political considerations, just another cost of the coalition. We have got these elections at a very funny time, and I'm afraid that is going to not help turnout.
Well, the poor Lib Dems are not here to defend themselves, as they say on the serious news programmes. Sam, let me bring you into this, because I know you threw your hat in the ring for one of the commissioner posts and then took it out again, but you've become the sage of the whole process. Why did you want to do it?
For me, I've had an interest in politics for a long time and experience in policing and crime reduction for about 20 years. So bringing those two things together gave me an opportunity to have a look at solving problems that I'd seen in Lancashire. I'm sure that's the motivation for a number of candidates around the country.
And is this the right model that we have? Did you go for it because you thought that's perfect, they've got that job just right? Or did you think, well, I know a lot and I could make the best of it?
Well, I'm not saying it couldn't be improved in the future. And after we get through the teething problems and learn from experience, there may well be ways of doing that. But it is a very significant change to give people a say in local policing. And it really challenges the idea that we've had up to now, which is that you get what you're given in terms of local policing. But I think also it's not just about policing, it's actually about crime. That part of the job title is very important, but not very well defined. And there's going to be an awful lot that happens there. And if we do get to the point where historians look back, it may well be more about the crime changes that they look back on rather than the police changes.
Let me ask you, Tim and Alan, much the same question, really, because this job vests a lot of power within an individual. Are we, Tim, having the right calibre of people coming forward?
I think probably what will happen in November is we will get a mixed bag. And one of the reasons why I'm so in favour of this reform is we will have diversity of models. There will be some commissioners who will succeed, who will be very active and very strategic. Others will fail. And at first. Some of them will start to emulate the successful model. Some, when they are up for re-election, will be booted out and replaced. The fact is, we won't really be able to judge this reform until probably we've gone through two election cycles, when we can see how not only who we've elected, but how they're then held account at subsequent elections, and we begin to see over time a calibre and a shift of strategy.
That's a bit of a gamble, though, isn't it? If I live in an area and my commissioner turns out to be a bit of a duffer, I will have lived with him for, what, 4 years?
Well, of course, that person is accountable all through that 4 years, like any politician. They may only be bootable, outable, to invent a new word.
Lovely phrase.
After, you know, 4 or so years. But actually, they will all the time be subject to media pressure. And that's not something we've had before, because the police authorities aren't recognisable or understandable to people. So, yes, scrutiny will be limited, but it will be better than what we have had up until now.
Alan, what do you think? Are we getting the right people? Are the right calibre of people to fill all of these posts? There are a lot of them, isn't it? 130, 41 elections. Are the right people coming forward?
Well, when David Cameron launched the hunt for candidates back in May, he said this is a big job for a big local figure. And he hoped, it said it wasn't just a job for politicians, but the vast bulk of the candidates in the winnable areas are undoubtedly ex-Labour ministers, former Conservative MPs, former chairman of police authorities, people who've been around the circuit before. And in that sense, it hasn't really pulled in a wider range of candidates. Two independents who at one point looked as though they might lighten up the sky a bit, Simon Weston in South Wales, the former Vecton Falklands hero, the Colonel Tim Collins, who was on the platform of Conservative Party conference last October, both quit. Tim Collins saying he wanted it as a part-time job, and Simon Weston saying that the whole thing was coming too political and facing problems with his past convictions, but hasn't yet proved attractive to the right quality of candidate who isn't just the normal Westminster politician looking for a further job.
Sam Chapman, your website, Top of the Cops, some will love it, some will hate it, but it hasn't been short of material, has it? I mean, tell us about some of the stories that you've been writing.
We've not been short of material, whether that be on the range of independents that we've got. And of course, on my website, it isn't just me that writes. I have candidate statements from several dozen candidates, quite a lot of independents, some Liberal Democrats, and obviously Conservative and Labour. The sort of stories that have been coming out, one recently was around a member of the senior judiciary tried to stop magistrates from standing to become police and crime commissioners with what seemed to be very little consultation, and what there was simply consultation of existing magistrates. We managed to bring that to the public fore. That was reported more widely, and the judges backed down. So there's new stories coming. I can't tell you about them all just at the minute.
Go on.
But they will be of interest. You keep your eyes open.
And what about the people that are coming forward? It is an interesting cast of characters, isn't it?
It is an interesting and varied mix of characters. There has been a tendency in this election for people to dismiss the candidates that are coming forward because they are not always nationally prominent people. But there are quite a list of local people. There are some who are perhaps a little peculiar, but there are also people who resonate, I think, deeply with local communities. A lot of people with police experience, although not necessarily people being chosen by the parties with that kind of experience. So there will be a choice out there. It will be entirely down to the voters as to who they choose. The interesting thing is how engaged voters will become in the election and how much they will actually use the information that is out there in order to make their choice.
Tim Montgomery, to the extent to which this has become party political, are you glad about that, or were you one of those who actually wanted strong independents and, you know, local businessmen? And people always raise the figure of a Richard Branson figure, don't they, being a police commissioner? Or do you think this is a healthy area for the political parties to slug it out in?
I have mixed views about it. And, you know, ultimately it's going to be a hand of the electors whether they want someone with a blue rosette or a red rosette. Interestingly, there won't be many people with yellow rosettes. There aren't a huge number of Liberal Democrats standing for this election.
Perhaps. You're smiling, aren't you?
Perhaps because they fear that they won't do so well. I think the Tories probably will do very well in these elections. Law and order, in every opinion poll, is the issue where Tories tend to score more highly with the electorate, more potently with the electorate than almost any other issue. So Tory candidates will have a sort of intrinsic advantage in these elections. But I do hope that independent figures will emerge and will challenge the orthodoxies. And opening the doors to new entrants in a political electoral system is a good thing.
But Alan, all these characters, some of them are familiar, Lord Prescott obviously being the most obvious of them, but a whole retinue, particularly of Labour ministers, but also I think Michael Mates in Hampshire have come forward. Now, isn't that a problem at the moment when people aren't that in love with their politicians to have another election that features very familiar politicians?
Well, I think the way these elections are structured, there's unlikely to that anyone without a Labour or a Conservative Labour can get elected. It's the fact of the matter. These elections are designed as a Conservative party. They're a Conservative initiative. And they're being fought on the first time. A single-issue election in British politics is highly unusual. And on the one issue of law and order, which the Conservatives traditionally had a quite a lengthy lead, I think they've been seen in a highly political way. This week, Saeed Wasi, the party chairman, announced that she was throwing everything, including the kitchen sink, into these elections and said that there was going to be a press officer and a Conservative Party researcher assigned to each of the 41 police force areas, which means 82 staff. I can't believe central office has 82 staff. I'd see this morning that in Surrey, they've already started to advertise for a volunteer campaign worker. Maybe that's what they meant, unpaid help in those terms is what she was talking about. But I mean, in terms of a side product, if a set of elections is held by one of the governing parties, midterm is going to be seen politically at Westminster as a verdict on the coalition, whatever happens. And if they can't win those elections, quote unquote, then it's going to be a pretty poor show for their own initiative.
And I know, Sam, obviously there are party political candidates, but also we talked about the independents. I know you've had some concerns about those independents and the fact that they're not really able to identify themselves in a way that differentiates one candidate from another.
Yes, there are basically two problems there. Number one, as John Cohen said earlier in your piece, they're not distributed evenly around the country. So some areas you have no independents at all. Some areas you have, you know, five or six. And there are some voters who will, you know, read the papers, listen to podcasts, listen to radio and TV and go on the web. But there are also people who will pick the ballot paper up in the polling station or off the doorstep and will make their decision there and then. And the truth of the matter is that the independents only have one description on the ballot paper, which is independent. They don't, you know, there isn't a lot to choose between if you've got four or five of them as to which one is going to be the one you go for if you haven't done the research.
So you could have someone from the local Rotary or you could have the Monster Raving Loony Party and you wouldn't really know.
Well, of course, the Monster Raving Loony Party will be identified as such. But there was a chance or an opportunity, as with most national elections, either to have a mail shot or to have the candidate statements included in a booklet that would go through people's doors to provide information on each of the candidates and give people more of a choice. But the government has decided not to go down that line. So there is an uphill struggle for independents to get their name out there to the numbers of people who will actually vote.
But we're going to talk about that potential mail shot and the funding in just a moment. But I know you've also had a few things to say about some research that was conducted by the Electoral Reform Society. They were predicting the lowest ever turnout for a national election. We called Katie Ghosh, the chief executive, and asked her how she thought the government could turn it round.
Well, we would like to see at least every household have information in the post, both about the elections happening and also about the candidates. We would like to see regional broadcasts so that people are hearing and seeing on local radio and TV all the candidates and they know who they'll be voting for. And we want to see a commitment never again to have an important election in the winter months when we know that people will be put off from voting.
Well, Tim, that involves more expenditure. I've seen one figure of the bill so far for all this about £100 million, or that will be the total bill. Are you for spending more money on things like mail shots?
There's always a balance here, and you know, I agree with what Katie's just said about the mid-November issue. It shouldn't be held then. And in an ideal world, of course, we'd be able to afford mail shots for everybody. It doesn't happen in local elections. Independent candidates don't get them in local elections. So there is a precedent for having to limit the cost in this way. And I think in a way, it's almost too early to judge what the turnout's going to be. Of course, it's not going to be spectacular, but the Home Office are going to be doing a big push in advance of the elections. I think what will happen as we get closer to the elections, local newspapers and regional media will start to focus a lot more on these elections. The problem with regional broadcast that Katie mentioned, of course, is that the boundaries in which the police commissioner elections operate aren't the same as regional TV. So you could end up having so many broadcasts in some areas that it would just be impossible to work.
But on the radio the other day, Nick Herbert seemed to be saying that however low the turnout, if it's a democratically elected vote, that would be better than having no vote. So on that basis, if only 10 people turn out, that would be better than the system we have now. Do you go along with that?
Well, at the moment, you know, nobody is really involved in this process at all. So, of course, if 10 people participate, it is better than nothing. But if it is 10 to 15% turnout, which is what some people are predicting, I think it will be very, very disappointing. I think we need to be getting certainly 20, 25% close to the sort of local government turnout to really give this important reform a flying start, and it's going to take a lot of effort to get to that sort of percentage for a mid-November election, unfortunately.
Alan, is this too much doom?
I think so. I think the Electoral Reform Society prediction is too pessimistic. I think it deducted something like 6 points from their turnout simply for not having a mail shot. I don't think a letter through the door actually pushes turnout up that much. I think that also there is a question about legitimacy, though, and I think we have to say one word for existing police authorities. Half their membership are elected local councillors, 9 out of the 17 members in every police authority, which, who have been elected at local government elections on a turnout at local government elections. And if the people who replace them...
But then I think
there is an argument whereby one would hope at least for some legitimacy that they would have at least as big a mandate as half the existing members of
the authority. But the trouble, Alan, is those councillors are elected but not on this mandate. They're not held directly accountable for police priorities. So it is the mechanism,
I can remember going about the last 20 years, crime has featured extremely strongly.
But it's also about rubbish collection and libraries, etc. Whereas what we've got with this reform is something very direct, and that's a huge improvement.
Well, if local communities get as aerated as the two of you, then we'll be fine. But let's leave that there and say thank you to Sam Chapman, because we need to move on. Because there's been another big political talking point this week: who's up, who's down, who's in, who's out, and what will happen when David Cameron, who finally executes that long-awaited reshuffle. Reading the runes is our chief political correspondent, Nick Watt.
All prime ministers hope that when they carry out a cabinet reshuffle, that they will sort of refresh the government. You'll have new faces on television. David Cameron has always thought that's a load of old codswallop. He is really instinctively wary of reshuffles, but they are a fact of life. You do have to do them. Obviously, there's been a bit of a tussle over the position of Ken Clark. There are those on the right of the Conservative Party who would like him out of the government altogether. That's not going to happen. But certainly, if he had his way, David Cameron would like to remove Ken Clark as Justice Secretary, possibly put him in as leader of the House of Commons. I think that Baroness Varsi will keep her seat in Cabinet, but there's a question as to whether she will remain chairman, as they insist on calling it, chairman of the Conservative Party. They're keen to bring in some fresh people for that, possibly Chris Grayling. Jeremy Hunt is one of the names who is on the vulnerable list. It's probably difficult to see how he could remain as Culture Secretary. He could get switched around. There was speculation that he'd be made Health Secretary. Slight flaw in that one, which is that Andrew Lansley looks like he's going to remain his post. I wouldn't describe it as a big job, but it's a cabinet post, and that is the position of Welsh Secretary, which is held by Cheryl Gillan. It seems to be pretty clear that Cheryl Gillan will be retiring from the cabinet. The Conservatives always have a problem with appointing a Welsh Secretary, as that they don't have a vast number of Welsh MPs. So the thinking is that Maria Miller, MP for Basingstoke, which is obviously firmly in England, done quite well as disabled minister. Thinking is that she will replace Cheryl Gillan, because Maria Miller was brought up in Bridgend. I think the obvious people who are sort of knocking immediately on the cabinet door are those members of the shadow cabinet who didn't make the cabinet, for the very simple reason that the prime minister had five fewer posts than he expected because of the coalition. Another minister is Nick Herbert. He was in the shadow cabinet before the general election as shadow justice secretary. He's now policing minister. He seemed to be doing a good job. I think we can be pretty clear that George Osborne is going nowhere. He is incredibly close to the prime minister, his closest political ally, which is obviously the most important reason for why he is unlikely to be going anywhere. The other important reason is that prime ministers do not want to change their chancellor midway through a parliament, because it raises questions about whether your economic strategy is working. You think of Margaret Thatcher. when she chose to move a chancellor, she chose to move Geoffrey Howe in 1983 after the general election. When she didn't choose to move a chancellor, because Nigel Lawson resigned, that was in the autumn of 1989, which was obviously in the middle of a parliament, and we all remember what happened then. That sort of basically triggered the events that led to her downfall a year later. So I think we can be pretty sure that George Osborne will be staying where he is, Nick Clegg will be staying where he is, William Hague will be staying where he is, Theresa May will be staying, and Vince Cable, as business secretary, will be staying where he is.
That's our man, Mystic Nick Watt, our chief political correspondent. Tim Montgomery, before I hightail it down to the local bookmakers and stick some money on the various potential movements, would you dissent from any of that?
I think that's a pretty good account of what we can possibly know. George Osborne is certainly going to stay. That's the key thing. I think what a lot of Conservatives would love to see happen is for Vince Cable to be moved from business secretary
to
Siberia,
any island you might name.
And the hope would be that, because they want someone like David Laws in instead.
Right.
So they know that they can't affect the number of Liberal Democrats in the cabinet, but they see David Laws as a much more friendly business secretary. Now, what would be Vince Cable's price for that? Would it be health secretary? Would it be home secretary? And could that be deliverable? That's perhaps the wild card in this reshuffle. Other than that, I don't think we'll see big moves. I think the chief whip, the Welsh secretary, are probably the likeliest to go, but you could also see the leader of the House, Sir George Young, if he doesn't go to the chief whip's position, and perhaps the Environment Secretary, Caroline Spellman, going as well.
And Lansley to stay, would that not be the greatest comeback since Lazarus?
Well, I think really this is probably the first of the two big reshuffles that David Cameron will probably make in this parliament. I think the bigger one will come in a year's time, by which time we will know a lot more about the economic health and the political health of the government. And it will be that reshuffle that people like Kane Clark and Andrew Lansley will probably be chopped. Until then, I think this is an opportunity at the particularly the junior levels. I think we'll see 10 to 12 ministers go in this reshuffle, which means it won't be insignificant. And this will be the opportunity for Cameron to bring forward some of the incredibly talented members of the 2010 intake onto the front bench for the first time, and that will begin to refresh his government.
Alan, Ken Clark seems to almost have totemic significance here. I mean, what's the importance of him? Why are the fans of Ken Clark so fervent and the enemies so vitriolic?
Well, because he's come the touchstone of liberal conservatism within the government. I think his rehabilitation revolution attempt to push through penal reform became such a target for the Daily Mail and the Sun and the other tabloids that it's become a Tory right touchstone. But I think it's a bit of sad that Ken Clark, I think on Monday and Tuesday, had to issue a statement saying that far from refusing to move from the job of Justice Secretary, he hadn't actually spoken to David Cameron at all about the reshuffle. But I think there will be casualties at the Ministry of Justice, and I think the Tory right will exact that some price. We'll see the departure of his close friends and colleagues, Crispin Blunt and Jonathan Gianogli, from the Ministry of Justice, and we'll see maybe people from the right of the party put into those jobs. But that I think is as far as it will go.
And what's, Tim, happening with George Osborne? Because to the public, I suppose, he would seem to be the biggest problem in terms of the popularity of the government and the economy flatlining. But is it a personal relationship between him and Cameron? Are they just too close for him to move? Or strategically, would it be a bad move?
On lots of levels, I think it would be a bad move. First of all, it's not going to happen because David Cameron and George Osborne are incredibly close. This is almost like a joint enterprise between the two. And I think if George Osborne was moved, it would be like the Ravens leaving the Tower of London. The big danger of moving Osborne, and I know there are probably lots of Guardian readers and listeners who would love the deficit strategy to be changed, but this isn't George Osborne's deficit reduction strategy. It's the whole coalition's. It's the Prime Minister's. If they were to move Osborne, it would be the biggest signal to the markets that actually the government was retreating from deficit reduction. And that would put at risk the government's probably number one achievement at the moment, which is to have such a low borrowing rate and low interest rates. Many on the right are unhappy with George Osborne as well. They'd like to see more deregulation from him, tougher policies are sort of on climate change. They'd like to see, you know, more airport building, etc. But to blame George Osborne for those things is false. He's actually, in my view, and on the Tory right's view, on the right side of the argument of those things. A lot of the things that George Osborne cannot do aren't because he doesn't want to do them, but it's the realities of coalition government.
Right, well, I think that's information enough. I'll get myself down to Ladbrokes, but that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Tim and Alan and to Sam Chapman, to Katie Ghosh, John Collins and Nick Watt. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Speak to you next week, and we'll leave you with the Lancashire Police Authority's attempt to raise awareness of the police commissioner elections. Sing along now.
The election is in our county. It'll never be the same. It's for a police and crime commissioner. Allow me to explain. It's a new job being created, one with lots of clout. It's important that you all cash your vote and make sure you don't miss out. So get this date in your diary and on your calendar, of course, because the Police and Crime Commissioner will impact on the Lancashire Police Force.
Remember, remember, the 15th of November, a date for your diaries, please take notes.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Don't you Brits feel like celebrating those 14 days of sporting glory? Of course you do. So why not do it with a strictly unofficial but suitably stylish Philosophy Football Design t-shirt? This unique t-shirt is a wearable, chronological and color-coded record of an unforgettable fortnight. And for Guardian and Observer podcast fans, we have a special offer of £3 off and free post and packaging. Curious? Well, to see how good this unique t-shirt looks and to take advantage of our listeners' offer, just go to guardian.co.uk/podcastoffers. I dare you.